There's only one job that you coppers would want me for. Well, you can forget it, Mr.
Devlin.
What?
Devlin.
I am no stool pigeon, Mr. Devlin.
My department authorized me to engage you to do some work for us. It's a job in Brazil.
Oh, go away. The whole thing bores me.
Some of the German gentry who are paying your father are working in Rio. Ever hear of the IG Farben Industries?
I tell you, I'm not interested.
Farben has men in South America planted there before the war. They're cooperating with the Brazilian government to smoke them out. My chief thinks it's the daughter of
of a traitor?
Well, he thinks you might be valuable in the work. They might sort of trust you. And you could make up a little for your daddy's peculiarities.
Why should I?
Patriotism.
That word gives me pain. No, thank you. I don't go for patriotism, nor... or patriots.
I'd like to dispute that with you.
Waving the flag with one hand and picking pockets with the other. That's your patriotism. Well, you can have it.
Dove, 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 notorious. Dove, 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 notorious. Dove, 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 notorious. Dove, 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 notorious.
Hello, and welcome back to A Place for Film, the official IE Cinema podcast. My name is David Carter, and joining me, as always, is my co-host in her striped long sleeve shirt, looking like Wednesday
Adams.
It's not
long sleeve.
It's not? Oh, okay. Hi. I can only see your shoulders. Oh, surprise. Okay. You still look like Wednesday Adams.
Good.
It is Elizabeth A. Rell. Say hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. How are you, David?
I'm doing good. I've had a marathon day of talking to people on the phone.
Oh.
Different types of phones. Internet phones, actual phones, no pay phones, no rotary phones, unfortunately. But, you know, phones.
That's
Had a nice, had a delightful conversation with past and future guest Terry Francis this morning. So that was nice. About some potential exciting upcoming new projects for the BFCA. So we'll keep our ears to the ground on that. But yeah, I'm doing all right. Next week is Thanksgiving break. I'm excited to not do anything.
Yeah.
For just a little bit. But we're not off next week. We have a special guest next week, but we'll save that for the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Made kind of a reference to what the episode's going to be about when I introduced Elizabeth.
I know. I should save this outfit for next week.
You can still wear it.
True.
No, but this week we have a very special guest. Usually we'd introduce them after we had gone through the schedule, but considering there is no schedule next week, but we have promotion for something that she is very much involved with, we decided we'd just get her on early. Our returning guest in the Hollow Two Timers Club for the IE Cinema Podcast, the world's patchiest podcast of recording episodes with guests, we have returning the publications editor for the IU Cinema, upgraded from her status as blog editor back in the day, returning to talk about some of her favorite subjects, Carrie and Grant, Miss Michaela Owen.
It's Michaela A. Owens, actually.
Yes.
Wait. Is it also Anne?
Yeah.
Wait, we do all have A middle names then, because I'm David A. Carter.
Yeah.
Alexander.
That's what my name was going to be if I was a boy.
Alexander?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But I'm not.
Was your dad also a fan of Alexander
it's
the Great?
Name. Oh, no. Alexander's okay. His name. I don't know that he knows. I mean, I'm sure he just knows the name, but I don't think he could say anything that Alexander the Great has done.
Well, he conquered a lot of the known world at one point, so that's pretty cool. But hi, Michaela. Nice of you to be here.
Yeah.
We're here to discuss. We're dipping our toes into Noirvember this week. We didn't devote four episodes to it. Also, I haven't really had the time to give my I just did 30 days of horror movies. I don't think I could do 30 days of noir films.
It's a lot of despair.
Yes, exactly. So we decided to touch on one that I actually like the fact that you brought this up, because after watching it, I'm also want to get into the nitty gritty about what noir is, because we're going to be talking about Alfred Hitchcock's somewhat underrated film, Notorious.
I thought you were going to say somewhat notorious film.
Yes, it is a notorious film for a few reasons, and we'll get into that. But first, we are going to get into the non-existent A Place for Film schedule for next week, but we're not going to talk about next week. We're going to talk about something that's happening in December, so join us there. Any room about me, let me dead it. I'm an open book, and your man probably read it. Look at my AP and these girls, too pathetic. Real back when I check my protector. Yay, call me patty cake. Michaela, you are spearheading something very exciting in December for the whole world to watch. What is happening in December?
Ugh, that just made me like have a heart attack when you said the whole world will watch. So on December 15th, we're going to be having a live virtual edition of the monthly movie roundup, which is a monthly feature we do on the blog, where each blogger picks one film that they saw that month. It can be a new film, or it can be like a old favorite that they just revisited, and they you pick the film and talk about it. So this will be a live version of that. So people will actually get to see our bloggers' beautiful faces.
Oh.
Yeah, and hear us talk about these films, and it'll be fun. I'm just trying not to think about it too much because it's so much pressure to pick one film to talk about.
When you sent out when the initial idea came up, and like the fact that we have to pick one film, like before the call, like I was very confident, like, yes, this is the movie I'm picking. Yeah. Yo, I had a stat, like, because the way I was going to pick my movie was like, it can only be a movie I own. That's the best way I can narrow it down, which doesn't narrow it down at all because I own a lot of movies. But like, there was a point where I had a stack of like 30 movies on my table, and I was just like looking at them and sweating, like, which I don't know how to talk about just one of these.
Right. And then my criteria was I didn't want it to be a film I had talked about at all on the blog.
Yes.
And not even like peripherally. I wanted it to be something new, something different. It's just, it's rough.
Yes. But I think it's going to be exciting because I feel as if our blog is like, everyone's way different. I don't think there's a lot of overlap. Obviously, we all like movies, but like, I think everyone's got way different vibes as far as what they would potentially pick. So I'm excited about that. So. Are we keeping it? I mean, not to put business on the air, but are we keeping it a surprise from each other leading up to it? Or are we going to know beforehand what everyone else has picked?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know. Because usually every month you guys just send me your topics or you send me your write-ups and I'd put it all together. And then you guys see once it's published. Yeah, we will be doing a written portion to this. So the day before the events, so on December 14th, we'll be publishing like a very brief version of the roundup so people kind of know what films to expect.
So you might as well tell each other then, it sounds like, because you can look at the blog post anyways.
Yeah. It was just, it'd just be interesting for conversational purposes.
True.
Especially because there's a couple people on the blog where I'm probably going to be like, I've probably never seen that.
I think you've, so far, all the picks I think you've seen.
Okay. I'm more referring to Jack. Jack's got some deep cut taste. And so I'm always like, I don't know if I've seen this.
His is the only topic I don't have yet. So I don't know what it could be.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, I'm excited then. Yeah. This will be very exciting. It's going to be really funny if, I'll save the surprise for who the guest is later, but it'll be funny if someone picked a movie that we're going to be discussing next week as also their monthly movie roundup. I hope that's not the case.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Good. But yeah, look forward to that. What is the date for that for our listeners?
December 15th. It's at 7 p.m. and you can go ahead and go to the cinema's website and register. It's because it's going to be through Zoom, so you can go ahead and register and get all set up for it.
Wonderful.
Now, will that be our official last virtual event?
Yes, it will. Look at you being the good co-host.
Good co-host, good house manager.
I'm pretty sure I'll be behind the scenes on that one. So I'll see you guys there.
Thank you for that, Michaela. And with that, before we get into our main topic, we are going to have a brief discussion about, hey, what did everyone watch this past week? So please join us there. Bougie. He say the way that thing move is a movie. I told that boy we gotta keep it lowly, me the room key. I done bled the block and now it's hot, bitch, I'm Tunchi. I'm mood and I'm moody. I'm a savage. Classy, bougie, ratchet. Sassy, moody, nasty. Acting stupid, what's happening? All right, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Did you manage to watch a movie this week?
Yes. I've watched many movies this week. Not many.
Yes. I know you have down weeks where sometimes it's like sports or TV or things like that. So,
yeah. We are recording on Friday. So, as of now, I've not watched Indiana, Ohio State. So, I can't talk about that.
Okay.
Quick shout out to Mildred Pierce, which I watched for the first time. Wonderful. Thought of Michaela during it.
Is that good or bad?
It's good, because I was like, oh, I bet I could have some words with Michaela. But true. I want to give a bigger shout out. Criterion has the films by Celine Sciamma, like her big ones. Not, I don't think the short films are on there, but all of her feature length films are on there. And so I've been making my way through that very slowly, because they are not happy-go-lucky, so sometimes I gotta chop them up because of my COVID brain. But Water Lilies, fantastic. Girlhood, even more fantastic. I'm currently watching Tomboy now.
That was my favorite of her movies until
Girlhood.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Yeah, like I'd watched that movie a couple of times when it came out.
Yeah, because I did see that you liked my review on Letterboxd, which was just mm-hmm. the diamond scene is the best, which it is.
Yeah. It played at the IU Cinema. That's the way I saw it.
I love the IU Cinema. But yeah, so they're leaving at the end of the month, at the end of November, from the Criterion channel. So if you have that and you want to see them, you got to get them in quick. Yeah, so I'm still in the middle of Tomboy, like I said, because they're just like, it's funny because she hits like queerness at every single age, and I've somehow just gone backwards. Like, that's how I watched it.
I mean, that's probably interesting in its own retrospect. I can't wait for her middle-aged
queer movie. What's she
gonna
do next?
Make that a box set, Criterion.
This is the director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, if anyone is wondering who we're talking about.
Yes.
I noticed I didn't say
the that. Director of one of the most devastating films of 2019.
Have you watched it since you got the Criterion?
No, not yet, because I want to show it to my partner. She's been super interested in seeing it. So
cute. Yes.
I know. I'd like to let Michaela go last, so I will say this week I watched this this small independent film. It was made by like a 25-year-old. It's called Citizen Kane. Have you heard of it?
You watched
by no. This, what's it about?
it's about this guy who owns a newspaper. I don't know. It's kind of boring. No. oh boy. No, I rewatched Citizen Kane for a couple of reasons. One of the podcasts I listened to was having an episode focused on certain aspects of certain movies, and one of the ones that they brought up that they were going to discuss was Citizen Kane, and I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I figured I'd kill two birds with one stone because David Fincher's Mank, about the screenwriter of Citizen Kane, is coming out on Netflix in early December. I hadn't watched the movie in a while, because it's a movie that you watch and you're like, either you decide, I feel like it's a very much a binary. Either you agree that it's one of the greatest movies of all time, or you think it's overrated for some reason. Like, I feel like that's every discussion I've ever had about Citizen Kane, is people being it's overrated, or yeah, it's as good as everyone says it is. Mm-hmm. So it was nice to like just watch it in my house, Like, I hadn't seen it. I had seen it in a movie theater a couple of times, which was nice. But it was nice to just, like, watch in my house and just view it like a movie I had seen before. And I'm on my couch in my underwear eating a bowl of ramen.
As Orson Welles intended.
As he intended. He would only be upset it wasn't, like, ramen with, like, a pork chop on top of it or something. The man liked food. I don't know what to tell you. but yes, it was it's an incredible movie. I don't really have much to add to it outside of, yeah, it's a weirdly prescient movie. Like, I mean, there's like whole, yeah, I mean, I'm just gonna invoke his name once. I don't bring up the name a lot on this podcast. It is funny that it is Donald Trump's apparently his favorite movie of all time. And it is like that, it's that great thing of like, he doesn't understand what the movie is about, or he never actually watched it. I don't know which one it is.
I feel like it's got to be the latter.
I mean, you can go on YouTube and watch this. Just type in Donald Trump, Citizen Kane. It's like he's being interviewed about it, and he gives his thoughts on it. It's like a good story about a guy who, like, you know, like did all the right things and stuff. Like, he probably should have married better. Like, that's literally all he takes away from the movie, is that Kane should have married better.
David Carter here, just wanting to, you know, be where fair is fair. It's not that watching the clip again, editing this episode, it's not that he doesn't understand the broader themes about wealth isolating you and things like that. He does say that, though they do seem kind of canned and written for him in this particular interview. It does seem like he kind of doesn't realize that the movie's also about a demagogue who essentially loses sight of what they set out to do in the first place, which is in itself very funny and ironic, but, you know, I'll let you be the judge of that yourself. All right, anyway, back to the
episode. Anyway, it is funny that, like, now post-election, that there is a whole thing of, like, he's printing the two newspapers and about, like, the results of the election, and one says, like Kane wins, and then the other one says Kane loses. Like, is there fraud at the polls? Like, I don't know. Don't know what to tell you, people. It's someone, the podcast I listen to, critic David Ehrlich, brought up the fact that it's like, that's why we don't really need movies about the Trump administration or the Trump era, because movies about demagogues already exist, and they have played out pretty much almost note for note as this whole presidential administration has played out. So I highly suggest you watch Citizen Kane if you've never seen it. Tweet at me whether you think it's underrated or, yeah, it's a pretty good movie. I quite like it. I still think F for Fake is still my favorite Orson Welles movies, but I'm not gonna sit here and like say like Citizen Kane isn't like the greatest movie of all time. So yes, Citizen Kane. I don't know where it's streaming, but I own it, so you know, check it out. It's a great movie.
But I own it. The rest of you can just watch it.
I mean, would it be? I mean, I guess I could check right now, but like, it has to be on Netflix, right? They're gonna have that whole Mank movie.
Netflix, like, doesn't have classic movies. What are you talking about?
I know, it sucks so bad. They like to make movies about classic movies, but they won't actually. Anyway,
that's a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other episode. So. Michaela,
yes.
What did you watch this week?
So I have been watching for the past week and a half a bunch of Jean Tierney movies, because yesterday was her 100th birthday.
I saw your lovely article about it.
Yeah, even though she's no longer with us, which is sad. But yeah, so I knew I was going to be writing this blog post about her, which went up yesterday. So I wanted to kind of immerse myself in her filmography. So I watched about 13 of her movies.
Wow.
About half of which I hadn't seen before. So that was great, because it just reaffirmed that, yes, she was wonderful and we should talk about her more, especially like revisiting films that I had seen before and didn't really remember much about. Like, there's this one. I'm not sure if I... I will hesitantly recommend it, because if you're not a classic movie person, it might not hit you the right way. Mm-hmm. Not to say like it's offensive or anything, but it's just, yeah.
It's of its time.
Well, it's just, okay, It came out the same year as The Lady Eve. It's called Rings on Her Fingers. Okay. So it also has Henry Fonda, who was in The Lady Eve. And it's kind of like a ripoff of The Lady Eve. So it's about like Jean Tierney plays like this con woman with the two associates who try to con like Henry Fonda. But it turns out he's actually poor, but Jean Tierney still falls in love with him. So it's like a really like light and fluffy movie, but her performance is just so good. She is just so adorable and like funny, and it's just, I love her so much in that movie. And I had seen it years before and thought, it's really not for me. Like, I'd rather watch The Lady Eve, but rewatching it this time was a lot of fun. So that was nice.
Where did you revisit Leave Her to Heaven during this?
Yes.
Did you visit it? I don't know if this is your first
time. No, I revisited it, and the whole time just like silently sobbing that we had to miss it at the cinema because of the pandemic.
Yes. Yes. Because of the current world events.
That is a fantastic movie that anybody, whether you like classic movies or not, should watch, because it's feminist in a very interesting way. Her performance is the best one that I think she gave. It's just, and the colors, holy cow, the colors. I mean, it's just a beautiful film to look at.
It's so vivid. That's what strikes me about that movie. And then also we'll get into it, but it's like a noir movie that's like about the femme fatale, like, which is like a nice little play on the trope, in my opinion. But I love her, and I love that movie, but like, she's great. Like, you don't get Rosamund Pike's performance in Gone Girl without Jean Tierney, essentially, and not just in Leave Her to Heaven, but so many movies.
Mm-hmm. So it's true.
Elizabeth, have you seen any Jean Tierney movies?
I don't think I have. So,
it's fine.
I know. I would
recommend Laura.
I take this back. I just looked up her filmography. I've seen Night in the City.
Oh yes, that's right.
One I haven't seen yet, actually.
I loved it so much. I gave it 5 stars out of 5. But that was one that former podcast guest Ben Helmrich had us watch for Noir Vember back whenever he was
around.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely have been meaning to see more, and I was supposed to see Leave Her to Heaven at the cinema. I had my ticket already, but
yes, I would say top 3 that you absolutely have to see.
Yes.
Laura, Leave Her to Heaven, and The Ghost of Mrs. Muir.
Okay.
Now that's one I haven't seen.
Oh my God. You have to see it. It's my favorite of her films. It is so good. It's so romantic. Oh. It's fantastic. It has a young Natalie Wood playing her daughter.
Aww. I'm seeing a well-bearded man in this picture. Is there a well-bearded man in this movie?
Yes, it's Rex Harrison, actually.
What?
Yeah. Crazy. Which I don't usually find Rex Harrison that attractive, to be honest, but pretty nice in this film.
You're a fan.
Yeah.
I'm definitely gonna, that is on my list. Gonna check it out during this holiday break. Elizabeth, when you return my copy of Notorious, I will give you Leave Her to Heaven.
Yes.
That'll be the trade-off.
Yes.
And with that, I feel like that's a smooth transition into our main topic, which is Notorious and Cary Grant and what is noir? So
I thought you would forget.
Join us there.
You paused so long.
Yeah, my cadence got real goofy on that one. I'm leaving this in the podcast, by the way. So join us in our main topic. Bye.
The more I ignore you, the more you adore. Yeah. Crazy. Need to come with a warning. Easy crazy about me, or you just crazy. You've been tripping lately. Too attached, got him making like a baby. Bullet wounds, backstabs, mama died, still sad at war with myself in my head. Baghdad, new, trying to come around and play clean. And my clothes fit tight, but my heart needs a seam. Why you wanna do the bad wrong? About to make this every bad, every tone. Ay, don't you hate when you hold it back down? Do you switch up when you turn? Not to be a clown. Ay, look, I ain't.
Hey, so Michaela, I emailed you. We were trying to think about, we had been thinking about a long time about what to talk about to you when you got on. We just knew we wanted to be about Cary Grant, but like, our podcast doesn't really engender a two and a half hour conversation about Cary Grant, at least not right now. Who knows, maybe in the future. So I just wanted to center it around one thing, and it had been on my list for a very long time, and people had brought it up as this one of his like great roles. And so I thought Notorious would be great to talk about this month, considering it's noir, and also a hotly debated topic as to what makes Notorious noir in the first place, considering that it doesn't have many of the elements that we typically associate with noir. So I was very happy that you decided to say yes to this particular topic. So would you like to give us your background with Cary Grant in this movie in particular?
Oh, God. you said you don't have 2.5 hours. I'm actually wearing my Cary Grant pin. I don't know if you can see it.
Oh, my. That's what that is. I couldn't make it out at first, but now it totally checks out.
Yeah. No, let's see. When I first discovered classic movies, my mom had a DVD copy of To Catch a Thief, which is a Hitchcock film. And I didn't know who Cary Grant was. I kind of knew who Grace Kelly was, and I didn't really know who Hitchcock was. So that was like my first film for all three of those people. And I don't know if you've seen To Catch a Thief, but Cary Grant's entrance in that movie was like bullseye right to like teenage Michaela's heart. Because he's like wearing this like striped sweater, and like you just see the back of him, and then he suddenly turns and it's a close up of his face, and his face is like the most beautiful face we ever had. So it was just like, oh my God, who is that? And then it turns out he is like a fantastic actor and amazing in whatever he did. And so, yeah, so I've just pretty much been in love with him ever since. And then Notorious is one of my favorite Hitchcock movies and one of my favorite of Cary Grant's performances. So even though I don't consider it a noir, I was super excited to talk about it.
Yeah. Elizabeth, do you have, I mean, you're a big Alfred Hitchcock fan, as we know. What, do you know what the first Cary Grant movie you ever saw was?
I know that this is not it. So there's that at least.
you watched Notorious yesterday, and that's the first Cary Grant movie you ever saw somehow.
Michaela would be rethinking our friendship, I think.
I would. Well, there's a running joke at the cinema, because every time I introduce a movie, I somehow end up mentioning Cary Grant, and I literally never consciously do it. It just always happens.
It's so good. Honestly, I would say The Philadelphia Story.
The Philadelphia Story? First
one. It's a great one.
It's like Jimmy Stewart is my Cary Grant, I think.
I get that. Yes. He's my second favorite actor, so yes. I get it.
So is like The Philadelphia Story like your like Avengers or something like that?
It is, because Katharine Hepburn's my favorite actress.
Oh my God.
So there you go.
So it's the trifecta.
Oh my gosh. Never has there been such a highly anticipated mashup. I mean, that is a wonderful, wonderful movie. I love The Philadelphia Story. Once again, saw at the IE Cinema for the first time. Kind of waited to see that one.
Mm-hmm. Now that I looked through this, I'm remembering that he was in Merrily We Go to Hell for like a hot second.
Oh yeah,
I'm like, man.
Correct.
And we do mean hot.
Oh boy. What are your thoughts on Cary Grant, Elizabeth?
I, too, find him very attractive. Mm-hmm. I, too, think he's a great actor, although my familiarity with him is definitely not the Michaela level.
Well, few people are.
It's nowhere near the Michaela level. But I can say I enjoy listening to Michaela's intros. every time, especially when she talks about Cary Grant. So every one of them, apparently.
It just happens, okay?
Understandable.
My introduction to Cary Grant is weirdly one of the last movies he ever made, because famously, Cary Grant, one of the few actors to just retire from acting long before his death, it's Charade.
So good.
I think a movie that I had just caught on probably Turner Classic Movies as a child a lot. Like, I think that one was just in heavy rotation, and it's just it's like a movie that's very easy to watch. Also because it's a movie in which you don't really need to care about what the plot is, because the plot is incredibly convoluted. And so you're mostly just watching this movie to watch like three actors that you really like all kind of bounce off of each other in different ways. But for me, Cary Grant is obviously super hot. But also, I think what sets him apart from other actors of this era for me is that he can play high status and low status equally well. Just meaning, like, he can be the most, like, in control, unflappable person in a movie. Like, no one can get the better of him. And then he can also, not to, like, a absurd degree, but, like, he can also kind of play the fool. And, like, people can, like, take the air out of him, like, very easily. But he never loses his charm in either of those settings, which is what makes Notorious such an interesting movie for me, because one of the two most famous things about this movie is that he's playing against type in this movie. Like, he's playing a no-nonsense like government American government agent. Like, he's not he is charming in that he is Cary Grant, and you find him very attractive, and his like stillness and the fact that he doesn't say very much is like alluring in some way. But it's not this like rapid fire, like back and forth between him and Ingrid Bergman. If anything, it's the rapid fire back and forth is all the sexual innuendo they're communicating with, like their eyes and their bodies. It's not through the words, like almost at all. And so I was kind of taken aback. I didn't know until I started reading about this movie. Well, I didn't know until watching it that he was going to play against type in this movie. And then like reading about it, everyone had talked about that as being like one of the big standout things about this movie. Mm-hmm. So what was it like for you as a Cary Grant fan watching this movie, Michaela, and like seeing them playing this like kind of like dark, this like darker version of himself?
Right. Yeah. That's always the interesting thing about classic Hollywood, is once you got your type, you weren't really allowed to stray from it. So for him especially, he was kind of known as the like screwball comedy guy, which nobody was better than him at being in a screwball comedy. He's so good. But with Hitchcock, he kind of strayed a little bit, like with Suspicion, the first film they did together. He was going to play a straight up murderer. He was going to kill his wife, Joan Fontaine. But of course, like the famous story around that is the production, well, not the production code, the audience, test audiences didn't like that Cary Grant was going to murder sweet little Joan Fontaine at the end of the movie. So they changed it at the very last minute. And you can tell, like watching the movie, like that they had to pivot and be like, haha, psych, he's totally not going to kill her, but he's still kind of a jerk. So Hitchcock really liked kind of tapping into like the darker side of Cary Grant. But from everything I've read, Cary Grant didn't really like, he didn't want to really stray too far from his image. He kind of liked, I don't want to say playing like happy people, but you know, it's like, because he himself really had a lot of personal issues. He had a really rough childhood. He thought his mom had died, and then found out when he was an adult that she had been committed to a sanatorium. So he had to like re-meet her when he was an adult. And there was a lot of issues he had with his identity, because he came from this lower class kind of Cockney family. But then he became like this Cary Grant character. So he had to kind of reconcile who he was and who he had become, and it was all like very confusing for him. And the one film he did do to try to kind of reconcile those things, oh God, I'm going to totally mess up the title because I get it confused with another title. I think it's None But the Lonely Heart. That's it. It's this film that where he plays like a lower class Cockney man who's really struggling to kind of get by and has a difficult relationship with his mother, played by Ethel Barrymore. And it was a straight drama and it flopped. And so he was kind of like, well, why should I take those chances anymore? And that was kind of around the same time as Notorious. So that's why, that's part of why I love Notorious, is because he is playing this dark, bitter, not exactly likable character. And he is so fantastic in it that you wonder what he could have done if he had allowed himself to kind of go to those places more often.
Yes, which is, I mean, both a strength and a folly of old Hollywood typecasting. I mean, mm-hmm. typecasting in general, but, you know, there's a thing about old Hollywood I do like, which is like, it's more like a, woodworker shop where it's, everyone has the thing that they're very good at and they can do it. It's very mechanical. It's very assembly line, like, but it'll be of the highest quality, but they can do it in their sleep. But, you know, the problem with that is while the movies were, in my opinion, old Hollywood movies are so much more consistent as far as quality mm-hmm. is concerned. They don't waver between like masterpiece and like garbage as much as I would say like the post like new Hollywood system does. The only problem with that is that you have all these, this large stable of like actors, writers, and directors who clearly had other ideas or other abilities to do things that you never mm-hmm. really got to see showcased. And that's why this movie struck me so directly into my brain. It's because it is really, I was really taken aback, like watching this movie and just kind of being transfixed by, and I promise we'll talk about, we'll talk about Ingrid Bergman more later, but like, I was so taken aback by just like how dark and like insular, like he becomes in this movie and like how just laser focused he is on essentially bottling up everything that is inside him. He doesn't get to say the things that he's thinking all the time, which is such a hallmark of those screwball comedies, is that part of the charm of those movies is that everyone is saying exactly what's on their mind at all time, just in the funniest way possible. And yeah, it makes this movie, it's mesmerizing, especially the way he's introduced in the movie. You get like yes. Hitchcock like famously storyboarded his movies, and that introduction shot of just the back of his head sitting in his chair in silhouette like gives you all the visual information you need to know as to mm-hmm. what this character is like. But it's also this incredible like you gasp because you're like, that's him. Like, it's like a very like, I'm watching a star on screen about to get introduced. This is incredible. It's wonderful. Elizabeth, upon watching this movie, what were your thoughts on Cary Grant as an entity?
I was thinking, wow, they're really like, they really want me to not like Cary Grant. They're making it hard for me. 'Cause I feel like you just always love Cary Grant when you see him in his movies, and his character sucks. So
you're not a fan of T.R. Devlin?
Well, he's just like, I'm gonna, you intrigue me because you're this woman who drinks and has sex and has this life and past, but I'm also gonna give you stuff for it every time I get the chance. So it's like incredibly infuriating. Like if this man were hanging around me, like I would probably still kiss him because he's Cary yes. Grant. But like
I feel like you're getting at what makes the chemistry between him and Ingrid Bergman's characters, oh, just them in general, but like their characters so fascinating, because from my very 21st century 2020 eyes, I was just like, I understand why these two would hook up. Like, yeah. Very easy. Like, I completely understand why these two would hook up. That part doesn't even not ring true to me. As a matter of fact, that's like one of the most modern things about this movie is like, yes, of course, like this, like, woman is like, you annoy me and I don't like the things you are saying to me, but I will let you go home with me tonight. Like, that makes complete sense to me. But it is interesting, and I don't know if this is a old Hollywood thing or if my brain of just not, you know, on the same wavelength of this movie, is just how quickly they would fall in love with each other. Because I'm like, she falls in love with him first, obviously, but like, he does eventually, like, you know, catch feelings for her in this movie. And that's the only part about this movie in which I don't, doesn't make me upset or like detract away from the movie. I just, I'm more curious on your thoughts, Michaela, as to, or both of you, your thoughts on as to how the romance in this movie isn't inorganic, but happens so quickly. just like how that chemistry is working.
Mm-hmm. So old movies, old Hollywood movies, that's one of the biggest complaints from people who don't watch them often, is that the love stories happen so fast. And to be honest, that's never bothered me, because old movies, there's just, time works differently in them. They're all about being fast paced. And I remember having one of my classes at IU, I think it might've been the film noir class, I can't remember. Somebody was complaining that, you know, people just, that, you know, old Hollywood movies are too slow paced and all. And I was like, what are you talking about? So I can't watch, honestly, watching modern movies is aggravating to me because they move too slow. Because in old Hollywood movies, there, people are getting married within the first 15 minutes or getting divorced at like 45 minutes. It's just, I like it. I think it's great.
So, Michaela, do you hate the Before trilogy then?
I've only seen the first one and I liked it. It was good. I mean, obviously it's good.
Yeah, it takes nearly 20 years for them to.
Well, I mean, like, you watch a scene in a modern movie, and sometimes it can be long stretches of them doing really nothing, and it just, it drives me insane because I'm so used to the fastness of classic Hollywood. So
you're used to like an economy of storytelling.
Yes, there we go. Yeah. So yeah, so that part of their romance doesn't really bother me. But what's interesting about Notorious is a lot of people pinpoint it as like the first like true romantic Hitchcock movie.
Yes, it is.
It is really romantic. I mean, it's infuriating to watch because you want them to just get on the same page and they're both working from different places. Like, I've interpreted it, watching it so many times over the years, as like Devlin. Yeah, he's a jerk. I will begrudgingly admit that. I also think he's coming from this place where he doesn't want to get hurt. I mean, he believes that Alicia has had all these lovers. I don't know if I buy that she's had all those lovers that all these men are trying to say that she did. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm glad that is actually kind of left ambiguous, because I don't take anyone's word at it. Like,
yeah,
I don't think it face value.
Yeah, I take her side more than I do all these dudes who are calling her a tramp. So I kind of feel like he's guarded. He doesn't want to be just kind of another fling to her. And I think it's kind of vice versa. She doesn't want to be nothing to him either. She doesn't want to just be like that easy girl that he was able to get with. So I think it's kind of just, it's just, yeah, that's why the climax of the film, when he rescues her, spoilers, I guess.
No, this episode, we're talking about the movie.
It's from 1946.
Like, yeah, it's nearly 100 years old. Just watch the movie.
But when he rescues her, that moment is just such a release, because he's finally admitting he was wrong. He's finally admitting that he does love her, and she's finally getting the affirmation she needed from him. Mm-hmm. And it's just, just the way that it's filmed is amazing. I love that Hitchcock pulls back and doesn't have music playing, that you just hear them whispering to each other. Mm-hmm. It's just the whole thing. It gives me goosebumps every time he, like, I was yelling at my TV. I've seen this film so many times. I was yelling at my TV last night, rescue her, go up, get her out of there.
Yes, I 100% agree with all that. And I guess to swing it to Ingrid Bergman's role in this movie. This is his bet. I mean, I was reading an essay by the great Angelica Jade Bastian, which comes with the Criterion essay, and she laser focus, like, pinpoints it that this is Hitchcock's best blonde, essentially. Like, only because, while, you know, this isn't to say that the other blondes in his movies aren't great in their own right and, like, give incredible performances, she has the most dimensionality of any of the characters that he's had in his movie. Like, she has her own internal life, and, like, nothing is black and white about her. Like, she is a complicated person. Like, she has been, like, her father is a Nazi. She's essentially like trying to find her own path in life away from that, like, clear her own name, not be associated with that. She does probably have some sort of, like, substance abuse issues, and yet she's been scorned by love, like, many, many times. And, like, that's not me saying, like, I'm taking at face value that she has been promiscuous, but it is pretty clear that she has been burned by, like, a few men in her life, and she is just looking essentially for a real connection with one of them. And she's kind of at this point willing to do anything to find that real connection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Including become a spy and sleep with the enemy.
Well, that's one thing I like about Devlin's character, is even though he tells her he never stuck up for her, he does. We see him tell his superiors she's not that kind of woman, she shouldn't be doing this, and they're like, you've read her file, you know. And it's like, what's in somebody's file is not necessarily what they actually are.
Exactly. I mean, it's the scarlet letter. That's essentially, to a certain point, like, you have to start. She's essentially, to me, it seems like she has started playing the part people expect her to play in order just to get through life unheeded. Like, she just wants to go to this party, get drunk, sleep with a handsome guy, go about her day. She doesn't want to complicate anything more than that. And if that's what people expect of her, okay, oh well, but there's more to her than that by a country mile.
Yeah, I know. And a lot of people, you know, talk about how Hitchcock was a misogynist and hated women. But honestly, I don't fully believe that. And part of that's because he gave women incredible roles all the time. Mm-hmm. Women are often the center of his films. And Alicia Huberman, Ingrid Bergman's character, is a great example of that, because she has so many different layers to her. And so I can't always agree with people who try to paint him as, yes, Alicia goes through a lot, but when you think about it, it's at the hands of the patriarchy. They're correct. The ones messing with her.
Yes.
And she's the one trying to survive it, and she almost doesn't.
Yes, I think Alfred Hitchcock, for me, I like largely agree with you. I think what Alfred Hitchcock for me suffers from, what I call, is that he's a very method director. So if he's going to make a movie about obsession, he is going to do everything in his power to, you know, Vertigo. He's going to do everything in his power to convey that on set. If he's made a movie about birds, he's going to terrorize a woman with birds.
Yeah, but some of that I don't think substantiated. I'm just going to throw that out there. Kim Novak loved him. She thought he was great.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the other interesting thing. I'm glad you brought this up, is that a lot of his female leads talked very openly and kindly about him. Like, they didn't really have bad words to say about him. Yeah. It was interesting. Like, Ingrid Bergman, the Lifetime Achievement Award that Alfred Hitchcock got, like, she was there, and she gave, like, this incredibly, like, heartfelt speech about what it was like to work with him all those many years. So I think he's a more complicated person than we, like, even kind of complicated when you listen to interviews with him, when he opens up about his childhood and, like, his things like that. So it's just hard. I mean, he's long dead, and it's kind of hard to, in the modern, by the modern lens, like, really dig into that man's psyche.
Right.
But
I don't want to discredit any body or any woman's account. I'm just,
yes, but he doesn't strike me as a Michael Bay, let me put it that way.
Thank God.
In every way.
In every sense of the word. Yes. Elizabeth, sorry, I feel like me and Michaela have been hogging the
That's
conversation.
Okay.
guys, I loved this movie.
Sorry, I keep thinking about how I love this movie, and then you guys are talking about it, I'm like, man, it's such a good movie.
Right?
Yeah.
Just like,
it is interesting how underrated it is.
Why do you think,
which I don't understand.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, Michaela, I kind of want to toss this to you as someone who's a more well-versed in the film. Old Hollywood and the filmography and things like that. It is hard for me to understand why this would get brought up more. I mean, even Angelica touches on it in her essay. It's just like, I feel like this should be talked about as far as like salaciousness and things like that. And we'll get to the sexuality of the movie more than, say, Vertigo. Mm-hmm. In those terms, like, especially given how much more mature it is. I don't know. Do you have any theories? Obviously, I don't have any answers, but do you have any theories as to why this is underrated?
I really don't, because it was a success when it first came out. Every person I've talked to or who's written about the film has loved it. I remember when Alexander O'Philippe was here a couple of years ago for his documentary about the shower scene in Psycho. And I got to have lunch with him one day with some other people. And we were talking about it. We were like, we don't understand why people don't bring this movie up more often, because it's an atypical performance from Cary Grant. Ingrid Bergman is just luminous throughout the whole thing. Claude Rains. Oh my, we haven't even talked about Claude Rains.
We haven't talked about Claude Rains at all. What a face. What a face. I love that man's face so much.
That voice. You have three great voices in this movie. I mean, it's just, yeah, I honestly can't explain why people don't know this more.
Yeah. And it also has, like, even from a people only really like flashy things, it's still like a pretty flashy movie. Like, you have that incredible tracking shot at the party to the close up of the key. You have all the scenes of suspense from like her stealing the key and hiding it, as, you know, Claude Rains is like, you know, talking to her and like trying to like shift her hands in ways. You have the suspense scene of them down in the wine cellar. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty flat, like, it's pretty flashy movie for a noir, in my opinion, mm-hmm. if people want to consider it a noir. Like,
right.
So it is an incredible score. I have no theories as to why this is. I mean, maybe to a certain extent, I think we just value those color Hitchcock movies a lot, those Technicolor Hitchcock movies quite a bit, the ones from the 60s.
That's what I was going to say, is that he just turned out so many masterpieces in the 50s. And a lot of people also, this was during his David Selznick period, where he was under contract to David Selznick. A lot of people kind of discount those films because they think Selznick interfered too much, and so they're not fully Hitchcock movies. Mm. I honestly don't buy that. I mean, who ever heard of somebody overriding Hitchcock on it, something? Like, so, I mean, like, Foreign Correspondent, that's a great film if you haven't seen Foreign Correspondent. And that's another one that people just don't really talk about.
Yeah, and I know that one of the big David O. Selznick things for this is that he wanted this to be the first post-World War II movie, like, about, like, kind of touching on topics, like, surrounding the war, like, the bomb was, like, about nuclear energy, because there's obviously the uranium being in the movie. But Hitchcock really wanted Cary Grant for this role, but Selznick was pushing for Joseph Cotten, who was under contract with Selznick, and so like he was essentially trying to like strong arm Hitchcock into like pushing the movie forward with the actor of his choice. And I guess Hitchcock and the producers, like, I mean, Hitchcock and Hecht, like, found like essentially a loophole around for them to like stay strong and like get the movie made when it was made, essentially.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there was some tribulations with this movie. We should talk about the most famous scene from this movie, just for people, because I don't know how familiar people are with it. This was something that I learned about long before I had ever even seen this movie, which is the kissing scene.
Yeah.
The telephone kissing scene. Elizabeth, did you know about this before you watched the movie, since you took media classes and things like that?
No.
Okay.
I know. Like the era. I know the Hays Code and like why, like in a certain era of Hollywood movies, they always just like rub their cheeks on each other a lot. Like I know the like background as to why it happened, but I didn't know until I watched it that the scene existed. And it's now I know. And I'm happy I it's know.
It's a doozy. It's hot. It is legitimately from whichever, no matter which angle you decide to view it at, is not this thing that's like, oh, it was hot for the time, but now it's like very chaste. It's like, no, it's you are watching two people be very intimate in a way in which had to be incredibly difficult or fun. I don't know which way they want to go with this for those actors, because I was discussing this with my partner and we were talking about it, and she pointed out like just kissing somebody, like, you know, can be a very mechanical thing. Like you can just do it and it's just a kiss. It's one kiss. That's why people can do it on stage and in movies like so easily, because you don't have to really be that in the moment to be able to do it and portray it. But essentially what Alfred Hitchcock is having them do is stay incredibly intimate and close and go in for like small kisses constantly over the course of like 3 minutes. And I don't think there's any way you can mentally check out of an exercise like that. Mm-hmm. It's
and they have to deliver dialogue and they have to get to the phone. And I think Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman both said that it was pretty awkward to film. Even though they were like best friends, it was not fun.
Yes, that's what I assume. Like I said, it can go one of two ways. Either that's, you know, a like, hey, we're both hot, this is fun, like let's do this a few times, or it's like a, I don't know, like this is hard.
Try it out with your partner, David, and see how it goes.
I think it would still be hard with my partner, like to have a conversation on the phone with my boss. I don't know.
Oh my goodness. Well, there, the other scene though too, like obviously this is like 3 minutes long, it's very drawn out and sensual, but the one shot of them on the plane when she's looking across him out the window and he just like looks at her, like I gasped.
That is one of my favorite shots in all of cinema. I love that shot so much, and it happens for just like 2 seconds.
Yeah, you blink and you miss it.
But then it dissolves and everything is just, it's beautiful.
That made me, that put me on his team. That's for sure. I think that's the point, because I think the whole movie, it's like, this guy kind of sucks, but you see him at the beginning and he's like, I love this woman.
He gets an arc. Like, it is nice that he gets an arc. And it's not sudden. Like, you do so him slowly see him develop, like, actual feelings and a conscience and, like, things for Ingrid Bergman as the movie goes along, which is very nice. Like, it's very organic to me. I didn't feel like it was just all of a sudden he has feelings for her and he must rescue her at the end. Like, it didn't feel that way at all.
Well, I'm interested how like the lines of innuendo hit you guys. Like, the one that always makes me like clutch my pearls is when she says that you can add Sebastian to my list of playmates.
Oh, that is a good one. Oh my gosh. Unfortunately, this is my first view. Sometimes I don't latch on to lines as quickly as I can. But my overall like feeling about the innuendo is like it's incredibly effective, and I'm kind of surprised they got as much through as they did. Mm-hmm. Like the way I see it is I don't know how strict like what the Hays Code, like what the process of like getting innuendo past them was, but this to me is like a very overtly sexual movie with just with the absence of sex or nudity or skin being shown in it. In a way in which I was actually giddy watching it. Whereas like sometimes you watch an old movie that like the example used earlier, which is it must have been hot for the time, but it's pretty chaste now. That's typically what happens when you hear about like sexy movies from the time, or, you know, it obviously are people who are bombshell, like Billy Wilder talks about Marilyn Monroe having like a lot of flesh impact. So like you don't really have to have a lot of innuendo with her. You can just show Marilyn Monroe and that's enough. But to me, this is like so much, it's like such a hard tightrope to walk, because like Ingrid Bergman is still like a very dignified person in this movie. Like, obviously, beginning movie, she's like completely drunk, still very dignified. Like, they don't, all her dresses are very elegant. She's, you know, she's not really flaunting very much while still being very beautiful and obviously very attractive. And Cary Grant, I mean, Cary Grant is just sex in a suit, so I don't really know how you can cover that up. He's just not shirtless, I guess, but like sexy no matter which way you put it. But yeah, I mean, the innuendo hit me like pretty hard in this movie. Let me put it that way. Yes. Elizabeth.
Agreed. You had mentioned her dresses, and I will say that that black dress that she wears, skin impact or whatever you called it.
Flesh impact. That's a Billy Wilder term. I did not come up with that.
Yeah, that whole racetrack scene to me is just like one gasp after another, because it's, you know, them trying to be covert and her trying to pass info along to Devlin while knowing that Claude Rains and his very terrifying mother.
Yes.
Not like her.
Oh my God. That's the best supporting actress for me in this movie. Like, that's the one where I'm like, yeah, just her smoking a cigarette in bed. It was terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, she's having to give this info knowing that they're watching her, and they're trying to like smile and act like they're just talking about nothing. And then when she says that line about him being one of her playmates now, meaning basically that they've had sex, and his face just, Cary Grant's face drops, mm-hmm. and you see him turn all of a sudden super bitter, not pleased. And just the editing becomes faster and focuses more on their close-ups and their reactions. And their reactions can be so subtle. And they all have to do it with their eyes mainly. And it's just one line after another. Like when she starts to cry and says, like, you could have told me, if you had just told me you loved me, like, I wouldn't have gone through with this. And he tells her to dry her eyes because it's out of character. Oh, that's just like hits you in the gut. And then he leaves and Claude Rains comes up to her and is like, you know, I think you two have feelings for each other, which is pretty obvious. And she's like, no, like, I don't like him. He annoys me. And he's like, would you care to convince me? I'd like to be convinced, which basically yes. keeps sleeping with me.
Yes.
It's just, yeah, my jaw dropped the first time I saw this movie, and it still does, which is makes no sense because I know it's coming. But it's just the way that the actors deliver the lines, and it's not dialogue that you would necessarily expect from a 1946 movie.
Yeah. That's actually kind of a good transition. So we were supposed to talk about the noir elements of this movie. I mean, noir is such a... The problem with noir in past IU cinema speaker Paul Schrader had, like, talked about this in the like lecture I went to, which I don't think was recorded, unfortunately. But one of the things that stuck out to me about it is that, you know, he is the writer of like neo-noir, like Taxi Driver is technically noir. He talks about how it does, like, noir is such a fluid thing because none of the, like, nothing can be a noir unless it was made like right after World War II, which this movie was, like, this movie was made after World War II. But all the things we assign to it, be it the water and the doomed hero and the private eye and, you know, the ordinary person in extraordinary circumstances, like things like that, don't like those rules get broken all the time. And yet those movies we still consider noir. But to me, this movie isn't noir. It's a spy thriller. And I sat there, and the only noir element I could pick out of all those things that I just mentioned, you know, in addition to other things, is she is kind of a doomed hero,
mm-hmm.
a little bit, but not really. Like, I don't know, but like, not really. Like, we don't know for sure. Like, I don't know for sure, like, she's going to die from the poisoning or not. Like, they escape.
Like, right.
But mm-hmm. I don't view her as a doomed hero completely. So I don't really know. And I tried to do some reading on this, but I couldn't really find much in the time that I had. Like, I don't know what makes this noir. And it's interesting that people so heavily and widely consider it so. And like mm-hmm. I said, it's a post-World War II movie. I definitely get that. You mm-hmm. know, there's like the paranoia and fear and hard-boiled edge of like America, like just coming out of this like incredibly traumatic experience and all that. But even then, like, it's already breaking the rules. Like, it's there's no femme fatale, there's no angel, there's no I don't know, like, outside of you don't want to trust authority, like, it I can't really see many elements in it. So I kind of wanted to talk to you about that as someone who's more well versed in these movies.
Yeah, noir is a really slippery term, because it was a retroactive term. I mean, they didn't think it was noir when they were making it. It's only something that French critics applied to it years after it happened. So it's really hard to pinpoint what makes a noir and what doesn't.
I feel like all of the definitions I've read are a lot more vague than what David was saying. Like, obviously, those are like tropes and things that you see in a lot of that. But like, I even wrote down, like, Britannica's definition of a noir is just cynical heroes, stark lighting and effects, frequent use of flashbacks, which this one doesn't have, intricate plots, this one definitely has that, an unkind existential philosophy. Like, that's all it says.
Right. I know. And everybody has different ideas. Like, earlier this semester when James Naremore and Guy Maddin had their film noir talk, and, you know, James Naremore wrote a book about film noir, and he's kind of considered, I mean, he is an expert on it, I would think. And I was kind of surprised when an audience member asked him, you know, what is an essential quality of noir? And he's like, he said nothing. There is no essential quality. And I was like, what? And then Guy Maddin said, like, he agrees, but he also thinks, like, there needs to be a dreamlike quality to it, which I don't agree with either.
Which I think that's kind of born out of, like, because isn't Out of the Past considered the first film noir?
No, the first film noir is, a lot of people think, is from 1940. It's a Peter Lorre movie called Strangers on the Third Floor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there was The Maltese Falcon is also considered one of the first, and that was 41. So for me, I kind of go with, like, the cliches of noir. That's kind of how I determine what a noir is, which is, you know, like, the hard-boiled detective. There has to be some kind of crime. Usually there's gangsters involved. You know, some kind of femme fatale character, which I guess you could argue Alicia is kind of.
But unlike Leave Her to Heaven, like, she's trustworthy. Like, we as audience member knows, we know we can trust her. Like, do we take her at, like, what she says is the truth? Like, she has feelings for this person and she wants to do these things.
Right. Well, and then there's also in noir, it's not the straight femme fatale, it's kind of the fallen woman, like Gilda. Gilda femme fatale, I consider her more, I don't even know if I'd say fallen woman, that's kind of an antiquated term, but you know what it means. Yeah, so I actually wrote, like, because I was taking notes while I was watching the movie last night, trying to figure out, like, why some people consider this a noir. Like, I don't know if you've seen the noir parody Carl Reiner did, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Oh, yeah, I have. Let me make my world famous coffee. Chicka, 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 chicka.
it's a great movie. And I wrote about it on the blog when Carl Reiner passed over the summer. But they take a scene from Notorious, the scene where Cary Grant first pops up and Ingmar Bergman's, like, pouring him the drink, and they replace Steve Martin with Cary Grant. It's fantastic. But so obviously, like, some people consider this a noir. So I tried to, like, write why I thought that could be. And so there's, like, you know, the fallen woman kind of thing. I guess you could consider Devlin, like, hard boiled because he's not exactly cuddly. But there's obsession. There's usually some kind of obsession in noirs. There's definitely crime because Nazis are bad. And then you also have, like, twisted relationships, which are really important to noir, because not only do you have Alicia and Devlin, you have Alicia and Alex Sebastian, and then you have Alex Sebastian and his mother.
Yes. So
there's, and then also the look of it. I mean, shadows are a big thing of noir, so I guess you could kind of interpret that. But other than that, I can't consider it a noir because to me, the Hitchcock-ness of it all kind of just takes over for me. Mm-hmm. So I can't Hitchcock did suspense and thrillers. I can't reconcile that with like he did noir as well. Maybe that's just me being stupid, but
like almost Vertigo is more of a noir than this is if you want to go by like certain tropes that, you know, are present in it. I'm not calling Vertigo a noir, but I'm saying it would more fit the bill than this movie would, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think Jesse, one of our bloggers, Jesse Pasternak, wrote about Vertigo a couple of years ago on the blog. And I think he called it a fairy tale noir. I don't know if that was his term or it's been a while since I read that post. But
mm-hmm. No, sure. Yeah, I just think it's interesting. But obviously, we're not going to crack this egg today.
Mm-hmm.
We solved it. It's definitively maybe a noir. I think that kind of putting genre to it. But it really is to me just a Hitchcock thriller. That's what it is. At the end of the day, it's a Hitchcock thriller. It follows all the rules that Alfred Hitchcock establishes and all those conversations he's ever given about his directorial style. It is interesting, you know, not to be like, they just don't make him how they used to anymore. But like, it is just interesting that one of the drafts of this movie, like the ending scene was supposed to have this like big gunfight at the end of like, you know, like there's supposed to be a lot of action to like get her out of the building. And like, that was one of the drafts, and like eventually him and Ben Hecht were just like, no, that's dumb. And just because the suspense of what's happening in the movie is going to be way more interesting than seeing Cary Grant fire a gun, like by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I do have to ask you guys, do you feel sympathy for Alex at the end? Because I kind of do.
I do too, which is like, I guess bad to say, but yeah, a little
but
like
that's Hitchcock. He's always messing with you and making you feel bad for villains.
When they locked the door, I went, and then I watched him turn around, and I was just like, he's gonna die.
But to a certain extent, it is kind of just desserts. Like it is like he's reaping what he sowed. Like it's not unfair in any way,
right?
Yeah, you do feel like a little bad for the guy. I mean, also like to a certain extent in movies, depending on the villain, I do feel bad when they are being like played romantically a little bit. Like especially if like maybe they're portrayed as like not abusive in any way, where I'm just like, oh, the guy just wanted some love. And granted, he is abusive because he does kind of force her into having sex with her.
Well,
but...
and like poison her.
He does poison her at the end, which is then once again, that's like vague because like that's more his mother.
He just didn't do anything about it.
I mean, I blame Claude Rains too. He was such a good actor that you can't help but feel for him. Even when he's playing like these slimy, terrible people, he did this movie with Betty Davis and Paul Heinrich called Deception, which is considered a film noir by some people, where Betty Davis had been with him and then kind of left him to be with Paul Heinrich. So he comes back and he's super catty and bitter and he has the best lines. Like the movie's not as good, but he's fantastic in it. I mean, just watching him just like chew scenery is the stuff that life is made for.
We've been going for a while. Do we have any final thoughts on Cary Grant, Alfred Hitchcock, this movie, film noir, anything of the like? Elizabeth, do you have any final thoughts for the people listening?
I don't necessarily have final thoughts, but I want to hear you talk about your opinion. So I read this thing that basically was like, yeah, Mission Impossible 2 is just a ripoff of this. Please talk about how you feel about that, David.
It is technically a ripoff of this and To Catch a Thief. Like, it's both of those movies. Yeah. It's how did I feel about watching it? Because I had never seen this, but I'd like kind of known that little fun fact. look, once again, I go to the mat for Mission Impossible 2, and I love John Woo so, so very much. Michaela's giving me the thumbs down. But that is one of those cases where the screenwriter of Mission Impossible 2, which I'm pretty sure is the writer of Chinatown. Let me double check that.
What? That sounds made up.
yep, Robert Towne, the writer of Chinatown. Yes, while I...
Oh my God, there's so many writers on Mission Impossible 2. One, two, there's four of them.
Yeah, there's a lot. But I mean, like, he gets the top billing as far as, like, yeah. He probably came up with the concept. Look, that's one of those things where, like, I feel like in some movies, certain writers and directors are like, and yes, it should kind of pay homage to this, but very directly, and it doesn't fit the movie. It's like a cute little thing. And so, like, no, like, this being, like, riffing on Notorious doesn't make Mission Impossible 2, like, a masterpiece or anything like that. As a matter of fact, I think the movie would be better off without it. Honestly, the To Catch a Thief stuff is more interesting because then it's the stuff that, like, Tandy Newton is doing in that movie. Tom Cruise is not, while I do find Tom Cruise charming in his own very specific way, he is not Cary Grant. It's, and he's not even doing a facsimile of Cary Grant in Mission Impossible 2. So my thoughts on it are disregard that when you watch Mission Impossible 2, don't go in to think it's going to be as good as Notorious. No. It's not.
That's funny you say that. I'm like, that's the one way it could have been. Mission Impossible 2 would have been worse than it is if he had tried to be Cary Grant.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I'm glad he doesn't even try to thread that needle. It'd be embarrassing for all parties involved, especially because Tom Cruise is at his weird, like, I'm untouchable part of his career, which is
long hair Tom Cruise.
He is untouchable, and meaning that no one told him like how not good that long hair looks. Anyway, Michaela, do you have any final thoughts for the people at home, or any suggestions or things kind of like this movie you would recommend to people who watch this and are like, I need more?
Well, it's actually going to show you something. I need to grab it real quick because I left it on the table when I had to.
Sounds good.
Our listeners are missing out.
This isn't a good thing for like an audio.
Oh, it's fine. We'll do a great job describing it.
Oh, great. But so when I first started learning how to cross stitch, because I am 80 years old.
I'm so excited.
I was trying to like come up with something easy that I could come up with on my own instead of following a pattern. Mm-hmm. And I just watched Notorious. So I made, it says, don't you need a coat? It's a little word bubble.
It's so cute.
And then the plot is, you'll do. Which is what Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman say to each other. So that's how far gone I am.
My gosh. Oh my gosh.
So that hangs in my bedroom.
When's your Etsy going to open up?
For real? No. Michaela, Ava and I have talked about doing little like crochet stuffed versions of like famous directors. So like we could all get on the craft circle and make an Etsy and make some extra money.
You guys could probably con me out of a few dollars, honestly, if you guys actually went through with this. And by con, I mean I would love to buy your products.
You can have these for $200.
Oh, no. I'm bad with money, not Jeff Bezos.
Back to the recommendations, though. God, my mind is a blank. Pretty much watch anything with Cary Grant in it. He's always good. And even if the movie's not good, you can just look at him. That's all you need to know. I mean, all his movies with Alfred Hitchcock, I would definitely recommend. Suspicion, I think, is actually really good. The ending kind of cops out.
But yeah, this, To Catch a Thief, North by Northwest, they're all bangers, like, truly.
Yeah, To Catch a Thief is... I'm always going to the mat for that one because it's even more underrated than Notorious. And there's a lot of people who, like, say it's one of Hitchcock's lesser movies. And like, are you dumb?
That doesn't make sense to me because there's so many, and I'm not just talking about Mission Impossible 2. There's a lot of media that rips that movie. Like anything with a cat burglar in it is usually referencing To Catch a Thief in some way.
I know.
So,
and that's one of the movies that Brittany Friesner, the cinema's associate director, now interim director, that's something that she's wanted to get screened at the cinema and just hasn't gotten the chance to do it. And I will be right there introducing it, just drooling.
Yes, please. Well, I think that's going to do it for us this week on A Place for Film. Michaela, thank you so much for coming on what is, in my opinion, one of our best episodes since we've come back. So this is me and Elizabeth were talking about how excited it was to like kind of get back to that, like, we're going to watch like a movie and like do research on it and talk to someone who's excited to talk about the movie. And it just felt like the old podcast again. So thank you so much. Mm-hmm. This is wonderful. I'm actually positive this will probably get some people to watch. Take a chance on the movie and watch it.
You're just being nice because I have to edit you.
At the very least, like my last long piece was already delivered to you. So
yeah, that was a doozy.
Look, when you got to review like 10 Blu-rays and like try to make it fit in under like a certain amount of words, you try your best. So thank you for formatting that, making it look better and cleaning it up. But we hope to have you on again in the future. I know you're not big on social media. Is there anything in particular you'd like to plug though while you're here?
I will say there is this great YouTube series called Be Kind Rewind that focuses a lot on female, like women in classic Hollywood. And she just released a video yesterday on Ingrid Bergman and how she became an exile of the Hollywood community when she had an affair and had a child out of wedlock.
The child being Isabella Rossellini.
Right.
It wasn't actually, it was her brother.
Oh, okay. Wait, is the controversy with Ingrid Bergman is that she just took, she defended Roberto Rossellini? Is that the issue?
No, she went to make a movie with him and had an affair with him while she was still married and then got pregnant.
Okay, I see. Gotcha.
From that. And that was a big no-no, even though it was very hypocritical and ridiculous and stupid. And the video explains all that. So it's really a good watch. That whole series is fantastic because she actually, her previous video was about Ida Lupino and Barbara Streisand.
Oh, great.
So
wonderful. I will definitely check that out. I'm always in the market for more YouTube video essays and deep dives and things like that. So great.
Once we're done here, I'm going to click on this, the United States of Tony episode, because Tony Collette is my favorite.
Great.
I'm already looking at it. I'm like, I'm going to watch this one and this one.
You can find me at Samurai Flicks on Twitter very sporadically these days, on Instagram at Robert Dolphy, on Letterboxd at Robert Dolphy. And check, I'll be at the panel for the virtual monthly movie roundup on December 15th. Elizabeth, where can people find you?
You can find me in all the places at my name. I'm very easy to find. For better or worse, I guess.
Please stay tuned for our episode with Laura Ivins, returning guest from Days of Old, where she will be talking about one of me and hers and Elizabeth's favorite movies, one of my favorite underrated movies of the modern era of movie making, Addams Family Values, the sequel to The Addams Family. We'll be recording that around Thanksgiving, which is when the movie kind of takes place, which is nice. So it'll be a nice themed episode. So please come back next week for that. Unfortunately, Addams Family Values isn't streaming on Netflix, but Addams Family is. So pay the $2.99 and watch it in standard definition.
If you have Freeform, I know it's on that, aka ABC Family.
Okay. So
that's how we watched.
Great. Or you can come to my house and borrow the Blu-ray. It's up to you. So that'll do us for us this week on A Place for Film. We'll see you guys at the movies. Good night.
Good night.
Yeah, thank you, Fester. I need to go back to the bridge just then. Thank you. Now check this out.
say what they wanna say, live how they wanna live, play how they wanna play, dance how they wanna dance, think and they stop afraid.